You're listening to Gossipint, the way to gossip intelligently. Gossipint is a podcast that helps listeners learn critical thinking concepts by applying them to well-known pop culture events, real-world technology-focused examples. Here with us today, we have Diane Duvielle, Karen Frost, Caitlin Hopkins, and I'm your host, Bobby Jade Apostolo. Details on our backgrounds in threat intelligence and cybersecurity can be found on the podcast bio. Although all participants today do work at Microsoft, the views expressed here belong to us alone and do not represent the views of Microsoft. Welcome to our creative and imaginative world of Gossipint. Diana, welcome back to the podcast. We are so happy to have you back. While you were gone, we did move from structured analytic techniques to biases, and you're coming in hot today with one of our biases. What are you going to tell us about today?
Thank you, Bobby Jane. It's good to be back. Today, we're going to be talking about anchor bias. Now, chances are you're familiar with anchor bias, even if you've never heard it called by this term. That's because anchor bias happens all the time. For example, with buying and selling, it's a big part of how prices are set and negotiations are made. A formal definition of anchoring bias is when an individual's decision is influenced by a particular reference point or anchor. The crazy thing about anchor bias is that our mind may choose a reference point that has absolutely no relation to the issue at hand. For example, Nobel Prize-winning psychologists Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman had participants spin a wheel of fortune before guessing the percent of United Nations countries located in Africa. Participants whose wheels stopped on higher numbers gave higher estimates than those whose wheels stopped on lower numbers. Those numbers should have absolutely no relationship to each other, and yet, somehow, the mind is subconsciously using that wheel as an anchor for membership in an international organization.
I was just trying to recall how Wheel of Fortune even works because I was trying to follow along. So you're saying if I spin and it lands on a number, that number usually just determines how much I win if I get the answer right, but that might actually impact the actual answer I give? That seems kind of like an extreme connection.
Yeah, actually, what I'm saying is that if I ask you how many jelly beans are in a jar, your guess will actually be influenced by whether you spun a high or low number on the wheel, even though those things are completely and totally unrelated. Which is crazy. A classic and probably more relatable example is the new car sales process. As anyone who's bought a new car knows, you should never pay MSRP, what we might call the sticker price. The dealership knows you won't pay that $80,000 for a new car, but nevertheless, the sales folks use that number on purpose to act as an anchor. This enables them to start the price negotiation at a high price so that when the customer starts negotiating down, they feel like they're getting a good deal. That's a pricing strategy that takes advantage of our anchoring biases to convince us to pay more money. Whoever puts down that first number is setting the anchor for the conversation. So it's in their interest to be the first to say a price.
Yeah. So for these reasons, buying a car is like my least favorite experience ever. Dealing with sales folks is like, ugh.
Right. A salesman might also manipulate you by showing you an extremely expensive car first, then showing you a cheaper car so that the cheaper car looks so much more reasonable by comparison. Even if the second car's price is higher than the car is worth, your mind will still view it as a deal, and voila, the dealer makes a profit. A lot of sales is really just using this psychology against customers to get them to pay those higher prices while still feeling pretty good about it. It sounds cynical, but it's the truth.
Did I ever tell you guys that I actually don't even have a car? For like 3 years, I have not had a car, and it's been amazing. If you can actually do it, if you can pull that off, I highly suggest it.
The good news is that, like many of the biases we've discussed, there are ways we can try to mitigate the effects of anchor bias. And in fact, the very first way is the absolute last thing a salesman wants you to do. Just walk away. One of the ways to reduce anchor bias is to slow down the decision-making process. By walking away, you can take your time to do more research, let the first price shock wear off, etc. You can even think about what you want your counter anchor to be. This leads into the second way to reduce anchor bias. Seek out multiple sources of information. In our car buying example, don't walk into the car showroom with no knowledge about what the make and model of the car you want should cost. Find multiple sources of information like the Kelley Blue Book prices or prices from other local dealers, and that can help you better understand what the fair price should be. A good example of this, by the way, is how the word sale skews our perception of the value of an object. Let's say I want to buy a baby stroller from a store that shows the original price was $200, now on sale for $180. Fantastic, I can save $20. But what if I Google that stroller and discover another store has it available not on sale for $150? If I had looked around, my anchor would be 200 and that 180 price would have looked very attractive. After looking around, I see that it's not that great after all. And in fact, now I have a new anchor at 150. Anything above it would be a bad deal. Anything below it is a good deal. We can also use formal structured analytic techniques like Team A, Team B, or Devil's Advocate. This would help us evaluate our reasoning and look for weaknesses. So for example, let's say a doctor has a patient who complains of back pain after doing some yard work. The doctor, who recently pulled their own back while raking leaves, has an anchor bias that is muscle pain. But a nurse, acting as Devil's Advocate, suggests an ultrasound to make sure it's not a kidney stone. You can even use a key assumptions check to examine the analysis underpinning your assessment. That's another way to combat anchor bias.
Diana, you very clearly have presented several great examples and included ways to combat them, which we love. These were particularly helpful for me, as it reminds me that I need to do a better job of shopping around. I'm terrible at that. I know I can get sold so easily. And understanding these things, you know, what's going on in the background of my head can really help me get prepared better. So this is all really helpful.
Yeah, and Bobby Jane, since we all love talking about true crime, it's also worth mentioning that anchor bias is one of the common biases officers and detectives fall victim to when investigating homicides. It's actually even mentioned on the Innocence Project's website as a contributing factor to wrongful convictions. I was watching an episode of Homicide for the Holidays, which is just another one of those fantastic documentary titles, just this past week, where the investigators temporarily fell victim to anchoring bias. In a 2014 Christmas Eve case in Southern California, a 22-year-old woman and her fiancé's brother were found shot, execution style, in a car in a mall parking lot. When investigators went to the family's house, it was discovered that the woman's fiancé was missing, prompting a month-long search for him. It seems to make sense, right? The most obvious suspect is the missing fiancé, and the obvious motive is a love triangle gone sour. But a month later, the fiancé's body was found curled up in the trunk of his own vehicle, and the investigators were stuck back at square one with no other investigatory leads to show for it. 3 years later, a man named Carlo Mercado was connected to the case when he was arrested for transporting firearms. The guns were tested and then connected to the homicide. So instead of a love triangle, the case was actually a road rage carjacking incident that turned deadly. And the biggest kicker is that after re-reviewing evidence at the scene, investigators found that Mercado's vehicle was parked within view of where the woman and her fiancé's brother were shot. They were so anchored on searching for the brother, they missed other evidence.
Wow. Well, thank you, Caitlin. So sorry about your voice. I hope you're feeling better soon. And what a great example. We know we love our true crime. And on this podcast, we do look at so many examples across several different categories. So let's go ahead and move forward on our pop culture, which is my favorite. Karen, we have our anchor bias when it comes to pop culture today, right? And I do have a quick question before you start. I wanted to know how easy it was to find pop culture topics because I couldn't really think of any off the top of my head.
You know what? It was pretty easy to find examples. That's because there's so many examples, and that shouldn't surprise us. After all, haven't we just spent the last 15 episodes talking about how we all fall victim to biases? Okay, Bobby Jane, here's an example. Is the Amityville horror book and all the subsequent books and movies based on the book a true story? Wait, before you answer that, let me tell listeners who may not be familiar with this book what it's about. In November 1974, Ronald DeFeo Jr. shot and killed six of his family members at their house in Amityville, New York. In December 1975, George and Kathy Lutz and their three children moved into the house after having bought it for a discount. However, after only 28 days, the family fled, claiming to have been terrorized in that time by some kind of paranormal phenomena. It was the perfect setup for a horror movie. The original book, detailing their experience, has sold around 10 million copies, and it spawned a bunch of other books and popular movies. What do you think? Is the story true, Bobby Jane? Were there poltergeists or other haunted spirits at work here?
Okay. I mean, the movie made it look pretty real, but I would always probably err on the side of caution. Like, I would need to see a lot of evidence to believe something like that. But okay, do tell us. Are they saying it's real?
Well, it turns out the story wasn't true. And not only was it not true, William Weber, the defense lawyer for Ronald DeFeo Jr. at his trial, wrote in People magazine in September 1979, "I know this book is a hoax. We created this horror story over many bottles of wine."
Wait, just copious amounts of wine, of course.
According to Weber, during a meeting with George and Kathy Lutz, they discussed what would later become the outline of the book. They imagined what a haunting would look like and how to frame events. They figured out what would sell, and they did it successfully. And a judge even agreed, calling the Amityville horror novel a work of fiction rather than a nonfiction description of true events.
I didn't know there was legal matters regarding this story. That's pretty interesting.
So the question is, why do most people today, even 50 years after it was admitted to be a hoax, think that this was a real event and a true story? Because every time a new Amityville movie comes out, and there are currently about 50 movies with Amityville in the title, it resets the anchor that this story must be based in some truth. When the opening credits scroll by claiming that the movie is based on real places and events, that simple disclaimer overrides later information showing that it was a fake. People assume it must be true. Otherwise, why would the disclaimer be there? Anchors away. And speaking of movies, anchor bias can be a plot driver too. Priyanshu Maru, a senior project manager at Amazon, posted to his LinkedIn back in 2015 that the movie 12 Angry Men is a story about one man having to work to overcome the anchor bias of his fellow jurors, who start from the point that the defendant is guilty rather than beginning with an open mind. In fact, not only does he have to combat this group anchor, he has to break down the individual personal biases the jurors have as well. And in the movie Moneyball, the player selection committee for the Oakland Athletics baseball team tries to evaluate players against players they just lost, making the latter an anchor. Manager Billy Bean argues that they have to ditch that anchor and find a new selection strategy. When they ditch the anchor, they become wildly successful.
All right, so an anchor bias can be summed up as the initial information you receive on a topic that becomes the basis for which all new information is compared to. And this could be good or bad, depending. But the idea is that you're aware of it in case it's no longer serving you.
Normally, anchor bias is bad, but I guess maybe there could be a good example. But something I want us to really dive deep on is the idea that the first anchor that's set is the one that persists. Celebrities know this and use it for their advantage. They try and make their public appearances an anchor that will portray them as cool or glamorous or avant-garde. But anchors can also work in their disfavor. For example, young female actresses who started their career on the Disney Channel often complain that it's difficult to transition into adult roles and careers because casting directors and audiences still see them as the characters they were, even if years have passed. An example of this, with which many listeners may be familiar, is singer-actress Miley Cyrus. From 2006 to 2009, Cyrus played Hannah Montana on the Disney Channel show of the same name. A few years later, however, she was ready to offer the world a different image of herself. One that was presumably more similar to her actual personality. At the 2013 MTV Music Awards, she danced around with a foam finger in a way that had critics gasping in horror and dismay. Shortly thereafter, she swung naked on a wrecking ball in the music video for her song, Wrecking Ball. Audiences in the 80s and 90s didn't blink when singers like Madonna or Janet Jackson gave sexualized performances, not to mention current artists like Megan Thee Stallion. But for a former Disney darling whose image had formerly been wholesome and all-American, the change was shocking. Nor did it help when she began to openly champion the use of recreational marijuana and MDMA. But as we know, anchors can be reset. Nowadays, when we think of Cyrus, many of us think of the wild, out-of-control rocker who twerked on stage with Robin Thicke. Although she's managed to reset her anchor, the cost was a steep one. Without having followed her career too closely, I'd be willing to bet she lost more than a few endorsement deals and potential movie auditions in the last decade. The problem wasn't that she was a liberated young woman challenging social norms about female sexuality. That's already been done. It's that she started off on Disney.
Okay. I more clearly see the point that you're making here, and you kind of like really structured it in my mind. She fought really hard to combat the public's anchor bias. So this particular bias does have a great name. Is pretty solidified and anchored down with my quote fingers. And it's pretty difficult to change once it's there.
Exactly. And anchor bias is also partially a factor in why Hollywood casts the same actors in the same type of roles. Can you imagine going to an action movie and seeing Woody Allen as a non-ironic action star? Sometimes Hollywood can put actors in non-traditional roles in order to turn our perceptions of them on its head and show the actor's previously unknown range. Robin Williams, for example, was an extraordinary comedian, but he was also a fantastic dramatic actor. But sometimes that anchor simply drags too heavily and it brings the entire movie down. We're supposed to be seeing a suave, debonair super spy, but all we see is Adam Sandler. Actor Rupert Everett said in an interview that he lost 3 or 4 major film roles after coming out as gay. While Hollywood is known to have a homophobic streak, It's highly likely that studios passed on casting him because they anticipated an anchoring problem with the audience. They predicted the audience would reject Everett as a heterosexual love interest, knowing that in real life he was gay. Nor has the studio assessment really changed over the years. Imagine the social media storm that would follow the casting of an openly gay man as James Bond.
Well, that's just unfortunate and pretty silly. We see straight people play... I digress. Off topic.
It's not just a gay or straight issue either. We all know how poorly male audiences reacted to the rebooting of Ghostbusters with an all-female cast. And the suggestion that the next James Bond could actually be a Jane Bond? Speaking of Bond. Audiences weren't even particularly pleased with the reimagining of the A League of Their Own movie into a TV show on Amazon Prime. Some viewers that had loved the original movie were anchored to that content and refused to give the new show a chance. And how many times have you read a book only to be disappointed by the movie adaptation? Anchor bias at work. Or at least that could be a factor.
These pop culture examples, again, always my favorite, are making me realize the prevalence of these biases in my life. I think I've justified anchor bias as nostalgia in a way, but that's why I love this podcast so much. You bring these things to the forefront in such a palatable and tangible way.
Nostalgia is an anchor bias. That's an interesting idea. It's also why if I ask you when 1980 was, you'll probably tell me something like 20 years ago, when in fact it's 40. Your anchor was set at a certain point in your life and everything else is viewed in relation to it. But before we move on from this, I have one more example that's still pretty astounding to this day. Back in 2003, the competition to become the Democratic Party's presidential candidate for the 2004 election was fierce. When Vermont Governor Howard Dean threw his hat in the ring, he was a long shot. But by the autumn of 2003, he had become the frontrunner, polling well and leading his rivals in fundraising. He was able to leverage a grassroots campaign that really motivated supporters. And then he started to slip, dropping to third in polls. By January 2004, he was clearly out of the running, but still holding on. Then disaster struck. While delivering a speech in Iowa, his unidirectional microphone filtered out the crowd noise, making it sound to home viewers as though he were shouting with wild emotion. He ended with an exclamation of enthusiasm right as his voice broke from just having gotten over the flu.
I'm going to have to look this one up.
This sound, heard on televisions around the country, is now known as the Dean Scream.
Oh no, no.
Comedians and talk show hosts howled with laughter. For 4 days, Dean became the butt of every joke in the country. His candidacy, already doomed, had no way to recover. Most Americans in that moment developed an anger bias in regard to Howard Dean that persists today. It no longer mattered what his policy positions were or his plan to manage the economy if elected. He was the guy who squealed on stage. When an anchor like that is set, what can you do? It's like when some people end up with nicknames in high school because of something embarrassing that happened. Now, for the rest of their life, they're stuck being associated with that moment or event.
All right. So ending us on a super uncomfortable note. Thank you, Karen. That moves us into the tech topic of today with Caitlin. What do you have for us today, lady?
Well, I think a pertinent example of anchor bias in tech right now is Elon Musk's takeover of Twitter.
Okay, coming in hot.
Yeah, but maybe not for the reason you might be thinking. We've talked about Musk in a few episodes of this podcast, specifically when talking about the intersection of pop culture, celebrity, and technology, as well as when we applied analysis of competing hypotheses to Musk's plan to colonize Mars. Musk is a natural subject for this podcast, so it's absolutely no surprise that we're coming back to him yet again.
I'm here for it. Let's hear it.
The world knows that Musk is a successful serial entrepreneur and business magnate. He's the founder, CEO, and chief engineer of SpaceX, CEO and product architect of Tesla, and founder of other companies such as Neuralink and The Boring Company. In April, he made an offer to buy Twitter, citing his belief in the company's potential to be the platform for free speech around the globe, and stating that the company needs to be transformed as a private company. Although a surprising pivot, it wasn't entirely outside of his wheelhouse. Musk's first business, founded in 1995, was Zip2, what we might think of as a predecessor to Yelp. In 1999, he co-founded the online bank X.com, which merged with Confinity to become PayPal. The point is, before his present ventures, he did have significant exposure to how people engage with information online. But since Musk took over Twitter, the social platform and company has kind of been in crisis, and not just a small crisis. In his first week, Musk fired approximately half of Twitter's 7,500-person workforce. To those who remained, he gave an ultimatum. Work, quote, long hours at high intensity, or leave the company with 3 months severance pay. Approximately 75% of remaining employees chose severance, leaving fewer than 1,000 employees still active at Twitter. Musk has stressed that Twitter under his leadership would be much more engineering driven, and that those writing good code would constitute the majority of the company. But that's hard to do with so few people left. And the situation does get worse. Advertisers have left in such significant numbers that Musk has floated the idea of declaring bankruptcy for the company. And there have been fumbles over verification checkmarks, content moderation, and impersonations. What exactly is going on here?
Okay, well, based on his current investors, a surfacing conspiracy speculates that the plan was always to destroy Twitter. But what are the professionals actually saying the problem is?
Before buying Twitter, Musk had at least an idea of what he thought a functioning, profit-generating social media platform should look like. He even posted about giving serious thought to building a separate platform of his own. And just after he initiated the process of purchasing Twitter, a leaked pitch deck for potential investors laid bare his plans to quintuple the company's revenue by 2028, decrease its reliance on advertising revenue, and introduce a mystery product referred to as X subscribers that would generate a projected $50 million. So the problem, presumably, isn't really the absence of a plan.
Okay, so he had a plan, but it's just failing at the execution.
According to at least one journalist, and the argument seems to make sense, Musk is experiencing the negative consequences of anchor bias. Musk runs Tesla and SpaceX in a very draconian, hardcore way. But that approach doesn't work for a social media company run by engineers who can, you know, easily leave and find jobs elsewhere. And Musk isn't the only CEO who struggled when moving into a new sector. Although evidence suggests that many CEOs can successfully transfer industries by bringing with them broadly applicable skill sets, the tech sector is a tad bit more unique. As a result, the blueprint and skills one has to have to run a social media giant aren't necessarily the same as running an electric vehicle or an aerospace company. And rather than pausing to gather a complete understanding of what he was walking into, Musk began making changes to Twitter right away under the assumption that he knew best based on his past successes.
Okay, so the anchor bias here is Elon's own bias.
Musk isn't used to running a company like Twitter. Any changes he makes to Twitter's policies or procedures are more quickly and more directly impactful to the platform's users than changes at Tesla or SpaceX. For example, in November, Musk had Twitter launch a new version of its subscription service called Twitter Blue. This allowed users to verify their accounts by paying an $8 monthly fee. But this has caused a wave of imposter accounts posing as famous people and companies, including LeBron James, Rudy Giuliani, and even Tesla.
Well, some argue that that was the most entertaining days that the internet has ever seen.
Bobby Jane, you're right. But approximately 48 hours later, Twitter Blue was more or less defunct, and the company was back to brainstorming how to manually verify accounts to ensure authenticity. Rather than brainstorming ideas and having employees challenge them to identify problems like this, Musk has been shooting basically from the hip. And it's weird to think, but Musk's anchor bias is in his belief in his own invincibility and business genius. And until he can overcome that bias, Twitter will continue to struggle. Don't believe me? In November, futurist Jim Carroll put together a list of, quote, leading signs of leadership arrogance that he believes are signs a leader will fail due to their own hubris. And the list includes dismissal of most criticism, a belief the leader has, quote, the magic touch, the leader regularly ignores rules and gets away with it, they're lacking in empathy and concern for others, and lastly, a tendency to blame others for failure. Carroll applied the list directly to Musk and predicted that Musk's control of Twitter would fail for this very reason. We might put it this way. Musk's personality isn't the whole problem per se. It's the fact that his former ventures were successful, which has led him to believe that his leadership style and personality are factors that will enable him to fix any problem. This inflexibility means that in the face of new and unanticipated problems, he lacks the elasticity to adapt. Or that's how it looked from the outside.
I think it's worth adding that Musk's fans have their own anchor bias. The press often talks about Musk as a genius and uses a lot of effusive language about him, and so people believe it. But there are many things about Musk's career that suggest he's less brilliant than some of his supporters believe. I'll leave it to listeners to research and decide for themselves, but there is very interesting evidence to suggest Musk has lied about his academic history and that he doesn't, in fact, have any degrees in physics. Not that one needs a degree in physics to be a brilliant entrepreneur, but just food for thought here about how we select our heroes and what we choose to believe or ignore about them. We should always make sure the anchor we dropped 5 or 10 years ago about someone isn't still coloring our view today when we have new information.
Well, as ever, I'm fully impressed with the work you ladies do for this podcast. And that wraps up today's episode. Diana, welcome back. Next week, our topic is the halo effect. Do I know what the halo effect is? No, I don't. But I'm going to be here and I'm going to learn all about it. So join us next time and we'll learn all together. This has been another wild episode of Gossipint. Thank you for listening.